Lecture 45, Alexander as General.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. How great was Alexander as a general? In this lecture, we're going to discuss Alexander's three major battles against the Persians: the Granicus River in 334, Issus in 333, and Gaugamela in 331. As a result of his victories in these battles, the Persian Empire was incorporated into the Macedonian Empire, and Alexander became Lord of Asia. We'll then briefly touch on Alexander's campaigns in Bactria and Sogdiana and India, where he pulled off a spectacular victory at the Battle of the Hydaspes River in 326. Now, all of these battles are testimony to Alexander's military genius and strategic planning, and they are what led to him being called great. But what I want to do after looking at these battles is consider aspects of Alexander's generalship that show a different side to it, and which I believe affect his military greatness. In the spring of 334, Alexander led his army of about 15,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry from Pella to the Hellespont, the Dardanelles. This separated Europe from Asia. He picked up more troops from his allies along the way. Alexander left behind the general Antipater as guardian of Greece and deputy hegemon of the League of Corinth. By the time the Macedonian army crossed the Hellespont, it numbered about 48,000 infantry and 6,000 cavalry, and it was supported by a fleet of 120 warships. Greek and Persian history is about to change forever. Literally before landing in Asia, Alexander threw a spear into Asian soil, saying that he accepted it as a gift from the gods. Now, this was not just a symbolic gesture. It indicated that Alexander saw Asia as his, because the gods were on his side. And I think it's deliberate to show he wanted all Asia for his empire. Now, this was a big difference, I think, from the mandate of the League of Corinth, which was to liberate the Greeks of Asia Minor and to punish the Persians. And it was a big difference also from what his father Philip II had envisaged. I believe Philip intended to campaign only in and around Asia Minor. So Alexander was showing that he intended to do his own thing, even before he set foot on Asian soil. Now, the battles and sieges that Alexander undertook in Asia show his military genius and the superb fighting ability of the Macedonian army. It was this army which he inherited from Philip, remember. Now, in three battles, Alexander defeated the Persians to absorb Persia into the Macedonian Empire that his father had begun to establish back on the mainland. Now, at its height, Alexander's empire would stretch from Greece to what the Greeks called India, the modern Pakistan. Philip admittedly didn't conquer on anything like this scale, so that's the reason why he's not the household name that Alexander is. But let's not forget that without Philip, Alexander would have accomplished little. So, no Philip, no Alexander then. Now, back on the mainland, the Greeks may well have been cowed by Macedonia, as we talked about last time, but in Athens at least, the flame of opposition continued to burn. We have no political speeches by Demosthenes in the assembly from this period, but we know he made some. It appears that he still maintained an anti-Macedonian policy, but its basis was no longer the need for a citizen army to strike against Macedonia, no longer the idea of uniting the Greeks against Macedonia either. Instead, Demosthenes' policy was now based on the hope that the Persians would defeat Alexander, that they would probably kill him, and that Greece could then go back to being its old self. Well, within a few years of Alexander landing in Asia, it was the Persians who were defeated, and so ended this aspect of Demosthenes' policy. Now, the first battle against a Persian army was fought in 334 at the Granicus River. This was in the satrapy of Hellespontine Phrygia in the northwest part of the Persian Empire. The Persian army included 20,000 cavalry and 20,000 Greek mercenaries. But Darius III, the great king, was not there. That's why this battle is often called the Satrap's Battle in the sources. The satrap of this area was a man named Arsites, and he was the one calling the shots. And he was the one who decided to engage the Macedonians in battle. Now, there was another general there called Memnon, who knew the Greeks. And what Memnon wanted to do was to pursue a scorched earth policy, because he knew that without provisions, Alexander's army would have to go home. But Arsites, of course, didn't want his satrapy burned, so he was able to override Memnon and force an actual battle. He shouldn't have done that, as events would prove. Now, the Persians drew up their line on the east bank of the river, and Alexander led his army to the west bank. Each line was about a mile long. Alexander obviously had to cross the river in order to keep advancing into Asia, so a battle was inevitable. The Granicus River was only about 3 feet deep, but it was very wide at about 80 feet. It was fast flowing, and the banks on both sides were very steep. And it's still like that today. Although Parmenion, the general, advised caution, and he even suggested to Alexander that they try to find another way around the river so as not to engage the Persians so early on in the invasion. But Alexander ignored him. Alexander decided to move at speed. He led his men down the west bank and crossed the river in a diagonal line, left to right, so that the Persians would focus on the flank nearest to them. This was the flank that took the heaviest casualties. And the maneuver has been rightly described by modern historians as a pawn sacrifice. However, this pawn sacrifice allowed the Macedonian line to push its way up the opposite bank, that's the east bank, and regroup as it approached the top, regroup into a straight line. And now the superb training of the Macedonian army proved itself yet again. The Persian cavalry gave way first, followed by the infantry, as the Macedonian line attacked. It was a rout. And according to the ancient sources, 20,000 Persian infantry and 2,500 cavalry were killed in the battle, but only 34 on Alexander's side. So we've got manipulation of the numbers again. It has to be more than 34 because of the pawn sacrifice. That would have been heavy on the casualty side. One person who almost died at Granicus was Alexander himself. Alexander was always in the midst of fighting, not just because this was the expectation of a Macedonian warrior king, Philip had been no different, remember, but because Alexander liked fighting. Now, think about this as we deal with him. Did Alexander know anything else but fighting? It's a question I often set on exams back at my university. Anyway, at Granicus, Alexander's helmet was sheared off by Darius's son-in-law, Mithridates. Literally, as another person raised his sword to attack his bare head, the Macedonian general Clitus galloped in time and slashed off the Persian's right arm. Otherwise, Alexander would have lost his head. After Granicus, Alexander marched down the coast of Asia Minor, receiving the surrender of towns or capturing others by siege as he did so. Then in the spring of 333, he detoured to Gordium, close to the modern Ankara. Here was the wagon dedicated by Midas, son of Gordius. And this was the Gordius who was believed to have left Macedonia and ended up as king of Gordium. Now, the wagon was famous for the knot made of cornel wood on the yoke of the wagon. And it was said that whoever untied the knot would rule Asia. Now, the story goes that Alexander undid it by simply slashing at it with his sword. The symbolism is obvious. Alexander made it clear to all and sundry that he was fated to rule Asia. And that night, there was a violent thunderstorm, and Alexander interpreted this as his father Zeus welcoming the new ruler of Asia. By now, Alexander was getting reports that Darius was leading a vast army from Babylon against him. The two sides would meet in battle in the summer of 333 at Issus. Now, the actual location of the battle is unknown, but it was fought on a plain by the modern Gulf of Iskenderun. Despite the overwhelming numerical superiority of the Persians, Alexander attacked first. His strategy was to penetrate the Persian line with his cavalry, to get behind it, and then to go after Darius himself. Because he believed that if he could kill or capture Darius, then the Persians would lose heart. Now, I've mentioned before that Philip knew his Greek history, so too did Alexander. And in Alexander's strategy, I see him here probably remembering what had happened to the Persians after Xerxes fled in 480 following the Battle of Salamis. The Persians lost heart because the great king wasn't there anymore. Now, Alexander never got the chance to kill or capture Darius. He never got the chance even to fight him, because when his line did smash through the Persians, Darius fled. There is a very famous mosaic which was found at Pompeii in the House of the Faun, and it's called the Alexander Mosaic. It supposedly depicts Alexander rushing to fight Darius before the latter fled. The mosaic is probably modeled on a contemporary painting, and it has Darius looming above Alexander as Alexander raises a spear to throw it at Darius. All around you can see the sarissas of the Macedonians. And Darius and Alexander's eyes, as I say, are locked on each other, and it's just those few seconds before Darius turns around and gallops off, surrounded by his 1,000-person bodyguard. It's a very famous mosaic indeed. It also has Alexander looking a lot like a very young Bruce Springsteen. Now, for the rest of the day and into nightfall, the Macedonian army pursued the Persians. Because once the Persians knew that the great king had fled, they did indeed lose heart. Their morale suffered greatly. So the Macedonians then had a relatively easy task of just chasing them. And they massacred them as they did so. The huge numbers of the Persian army now worked against them because they slowed the men down. Moreover, the infantry fled first. And that meant the cavalry was behind the infantrymen. And as the infantrymen rushed off, the cavalry, of course, which was moving faster, came behind them and mowed them down, killing more in an effort to get away. We're told that the Macedonians crossed a ravine on a pile of heaped up corpses. This becomes a bridge of corpses. Now, this was a great victory for Alexander. But at the same time, we shouldn't really underestimate the role of luck in it, thanks to Darius unexpectedly fleeing. What if he hadn't fled? The final battle against the Persians, who were once again led by Darius, was in September of 331 at Gaugamela. Now, this is probably the modern village of Tel Gamel in northern Iraq. By now, Alexander had successfully besieged a number of places, most famously Tyre and Gaza. He'd come to control Syria and the Levantine coast, and he'd received the submission of Egypt. Now, precise numbers for the Persian army at Gaugamela are not known. Some sources give 200,000 infantry and 45,000 cavalry, while other sources give 1,000,000 infantry and 400,000 cavalry. The Macedonian army was about 47,000, of infantry and perhaps 20,000 of cavalry. So whatever the Persian number was, Alexander was again terribly outnumbered. And of more concern for Alexander perhaps than the actual numbers was Darius's corps of 200 scythe chariots. Now these had razor sharp scythes attached to the wheels, the chassis and the yoke pole. Moreover, Darius was supported by the satrap of Bactria, Bessus. Now, the cavalry from Bactria, as well as neighboring Sogdiana, which is northern Afghanistan, was first class, and it was easily on a par with the Macedonian. So Alexander now had his work cut out for him. His strategy, once again, was to try to capture or kill Darius. Now, the two sides, Macedonia and Persia, had been at Gaugamela for several days, and Alexander had conned Darius into setting up his line and not standing his men down in case the Macedonians suddenly attacked. Now, because Darius deployed his line, that gave Alexander the chance to study it and to prepare his own defense and then attack. And so, when the two sides did engage in battle, and Darius released his corps of 200 scythe chariots, the Macedonian phalanx opened up gaps on a prearranged signal so that the chariots thundered through them. And the Macedonian soldiers then simply turned around and shot the riders and the horses of these chariots. Now, obviously some Macedonians would have perished at the hands of the scythe chariots, but this big corps was effectively rendered null by Alexander's actions. And once again, we see the superb training of the Macedonian army. The battle was loud and noisy, but Alexander would have been using things like trumpets to produce a very shrill sound, like a car horn today. So once his men heard, who knows, three blows on a trumpet or something, those standing at this particular part of the phalanx moved to the left, those standing at this particular part moved to the right, creating a gap that the chariots thundered through. Apart from a few anxious moments when the Macedonian left wing under Parmenion nearly gave way, the battle was another Macedonian victory. Because when gaps in the Persian line did open up, Alexander was through them in a flash. The Persian losses were said to be 56,000 to the Macedonians 1,200. And again, I think we've got to take these figures with a big pinch of salt. But Darius fled one more time, this time to Bactria with Bessus. Alexander pursued Darius at first, but then gave up as night fell and returned to the battlefield. Now, after Gaugamela, Alexander marched southwards to Babylon, where he took up residence in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. Babylon was something like the Las Vegas of Iraq, and the army enjoyed a month there of R&R. Then the army pushed on to Susa, and there in one of the palace's rooms, Alexander came across the statues that the Persians had seized when they ransacked Athens in 480. And these statues included the one of Harmodius and Aristogiton. And Alexander sent them back to Greece. By January of 330, Alexander was in Persepolis, the palace of Darius and Xerxes. According to Diodorus, this was the most hated city in Asia. And Alexander's men ransacked the place, the king condoning their actions. And what's more, before the army left Persepolis, about 3 or 4 months later, so we're now in the spring of 330, the palace burned to the ground. The victory at Gaugamela meant that Alexander was in effect great king, although he never took that title. He would call himself Lord of Asia. And the burning of the palace at Persepolis was symbolic. It meant that the old order was no more. There was a new king in town now. The occupation of Persepolis may also have had an impact back on the mainland. In 331, the Spartans under King Agis went to war against Antipater, and they tried to rouse the Greeks to join them. Now, Agis's rising, by the way, was a war. It wasn't a revolt, because Sparta wasn't a member of the League of Corinth, remember? Anyway, Agis was spectacularly unsuccessful. Even Demosthenes spoke against supporting him, and Antipater easily defeated and killed him the following year. Now, by then, news of Alexander's successes in Asia were widely known, and the implications of his taking Persepolis were obvious. So the Greeks might finally be realizing that Alexander was here to stay, and they'd no wish to suffer the fate of Thebes if they revolted. This is how Alexander kept Greece cowed while he was away, as we said last time. In the meantime, back to Asia, Bessus and some of the other satraps overthrew Darius and murdered him. The story goes that Alexander caught up with Darius minutes after he was killed at a place called Hecatompylos. But nevertheless, Alexander still ordered a lavish burial for Darius in keeping with the fact that he had been great king. Bessus, however, now declared himself as great king. He took the name Artaxerxes V. And this forced Alexander to pursue him into Bactria and Sogdiana. Now, this new campaign marks a big departure from the original mandate of the League of Corinth. The Persian Empire was no more, Darius was dead, and to all intents and purposes, Alexander and his men could go home. Now, although Bactria and Sogdiana were technically part of the Persian Empire, in reality, these places were far removed from Persian sphere of influence. The chieftains of these tribes were left to their own devices, so it was a case of the Persian king could call them satraps if he wanted to, as long as he left them alone and didn't try to encroach on their power. Now, Alexander probably didn't need to invade Bactria at this time. And this is what I mean by, did he know anything else but fighting? Well, his men didn't seem to think so either, and there was considerable dissatisfaction voiced by them at Hecatompylos. In the end, Alexander won out by saying that while Bessus was alive, security of the new Asian Empire would be threatened. The new Asian Empire. So Alexander's goals were changing dramatically, and he was even more the imperialist now. I see, by the way, that in that initial descent at Hecatompylos, voiced by his men, the origins of the later mutinies against him, something we'll come on to shortly. Now, some of the hardest fighting that the Macedonians ever took part in was in Bactria and Sogdiana for the next 3 years. But by 327, Bessus was dead, and Alexander believed that he had conquered these areas as well. Well, unfortunately for Alexander, defeated in battle doesn't mean conquered. We're talking about what is today Afghanistan. And as the British in the 19th century and the Russians in the 20th found, these native peoples are not conquered by anyone. The Pashtun tribes of the present northwest frontier of Afghanistan are constantly fighting each other. But there is the saying today that the Pashtun are only united when they face a common enemy. Well, in the early 330s BC, that is exactly what Alexander was. After Bactria and Sogdiana, Alexander pushed on into India, or rather in post-partition language, present-day Pakistan. Here he would fight only one major battle against the Indian prince Porus at the Hydaspes River in 326. Now, as Alexander entered India, various rulers surrendered to him, including Taxiles, the prince of Taxila, which is about 20 miles northwest of the modern Islamabad, the site of one of the world's great cricket grounds. Taxila was the largest city between the Indus and the Hydaspes or the Jhelum rivers. Here, Alexander learned that a neighboring prince called Porus, who ruled a large area of the Punjab between the rivers Hydaspes and the Akesanese, that's the Chenab, had defied him. This was a personal affront to Alexander. It was very similar to what the Thebans had done in 335. Look what happened to them. And so Alexander immediately set off to do battle with Porus. He met him at the Hydaspes River, and Porus had a big army with him, 4,000 cavalry, 30,000 infantry, and 200 elephants. Now, Alexander's strategy was to make Porus think that the entire Macedonian army was camped on the riverbank opposite him. In actual fact, only a small contingent of men was there, and they were burning a lot of lights and making a lot of noise. Now, under cover of darkness, Alexander led the bulk of the army across the river downstream from Porus' forces. The idea was to attack them unexpectedly. Now, there was a miscalculation about the width of the Hydaspes, and this cost Alexander the element of surprise. Alexander got to what he thought was the other bank of the river, but it was only an island in the middle of it. And it was with no small difficulty that the men made it to the opposite bank, because the river was also very swollen now, thanks to the falling monsoon rains. The Macedonians engaged Porus' army, and victory went to them. Alexander ordered his men to wound the elephants so that they turned around and stampeded back on the Indian line. At the same time, the Macedonian cavalry encircled that Indian line, and the battle was over. Porus survived and Alexander spared him. In actual fact, he kept him in power, turning him into something of a vassal. That didn't sit very well with the men, by the way. Now, this victory at the Hydaspes was the high point of Alexander's time in India. After it, he besieged a number of towns that defied him, massacring the inhabitants when he took them. In fact, Alexander's guilty of genocide. There's no question that as he marched further east through Asia, the brutality increased dramatically. He also wasn't prepared to stop marching east, and this was his undoing. After 70 days of marching through the drenching monsoon rains, suffering dysentery, men dying from snake bites, snakes they'd never seen before, the men had had enough. At the Hephaestus River, the modern Beas, they mutinied, and Alexander was forced to turn back, apparently on the long march back to Greece. Now, leaving India, he marched westwards through the Gedrosian Desert, during which about a third of the men with him died because of the hostile natural conditions. In the meantime, Bactria and Sogdiana revolted, and there wasn't a thing he could do. 2 years later, in 324 at Opis, the army mutinied again, this time over Alexander's policy to discharge his veterans. He'd also made it clear by now that he intended to invade Arabia. So his powers of persuasion were unable to end the Opis mutiny in 324. And after 3 days, he was successful only when he stopped talking and shamed the men into giving in by transferring Macedonian military commands to Persians. A year later, in Babylon, in June 323, Alexander died, aged 32 years and 8 months. This was on the eve of the campaign to Arabia. So much for going home. There's no doubt that on the battlefield, Alexander was a military genius. However, these inglorious endings to his campaign in Asia need to make us rethink his relations with his men. And there are also aspects of this campaign that equally affect his generalship. For example, after Issus, Alexander allowed Darius to escape because he wanted to go to Egypt to consult the oracle of Zeus Amon. This was for personal reasons. But as a result, Darius was able to regroup and Alexander was forced to do battle with him again at Gaugamela. Then we have the two mutinies at the Hephaestus River in 326 and at Opis in 324. Although Alexander was not replaced by someone else, as is more often usually the case in a mutiny, the army had had enough with him, with where he was wanting to go, and again, for why he was wanting to go there, the personal reasons. These mutinies show a vote of no confidence in Alexander as a military commander and as a king. He'd lost touch with his men, and that wasn't a great thing. There's also that terrible march across the Gedrosian Desert. This was a major logistical blunder on Alexander's part. So why didn't he just march westwards by the same route as he'd taken when he came from there a few years before? The answer is personal again. Dionysus the god, with whom Alexander was now identifying, had traveled through the desert. Cyrus the Great of Persia had tried to do the same thing, but failed. Alexander wanted the personal glory of marching through the desert, regardless of the cost to his men. Again, we shouldn't expect a king and a commander to disregard the safety of his men in this way. Another thing that Alexander was doing constantly was demanding reinforcements from Antipater in Greece. And this was the result of these huge numbers of casualties from Alexander's campaigns. That he was stretching Antipater's forces considerably meant nothing to Alexander, who just wanted to keep marching eastwards. But a united Greek revolt could have detrimentally affected the Macedonian hegemony of Greece. We notice how Alexander's reason for doing something is personal, for his own military reputation. In the process, tens of thousands of the men in his army died, and hundreds of thousands of Asians did so. Now, as I said earlier, there's no question that Alexander's victories were astonishing, especially given the numbers of the enemy he always faced. And there's also no question that he was prepared to fight as well, and not be a Napoleon type. You know, okay guys, you fight over there and I'll be 3 miles in the opposite direction. That's what I would be saying. But at the same time, there were serious downsides to Alexander's campaigns and to him as a leader and general. And they must surely make us question the greatness of him as a general. The same is true when we consider Alexander as a king. And to this we turn in our next lecture. Thank you very much.